This is the More Than Right podcast, and I'm your host, Steve Lopez. As you've no doubt seen on the news, massive demonstrations, mostly on university campuses, have erupted across the United States in support of Hamas and the Palestinian people. And it is impossible to separate Hamas from the Palestinians of Gaza, considering their overwhelming support for the terrorists. According to a poll released last month by the Palestinian Center for Policy and Survey Research, quote, almost all Palestinians think Israel is committing war crimes, while almost all believe Hamas is not committing war crimes in the current war. Moreover, more than 90% believe Hamas did not commit any atrocities against Israeli civilians during its October 7th offensive, unquote. And that brings us back to America's youth. Like Palestinians, young U.S. voters ignore the genocidal atrocities committed by Hamas and, instead, support its ambitions to see the mass murder of Jews and destruction of Israel. Writing in Time magazine, the CEO of the Anti-Defamation League, Jonathan Greenblatt, said, quote, negative attitudes about Jews and negative experiences for Jews, by every metric, are growing, not fading. And most troubling, anti-Semitism, for the first time, is growing among younger generations of Americans, portending a very different and dark future for the American Jewish community, unquote. An ADL survey found 24% of Americans, quote, harbor extensive anti-Semitic prejudice, up from 20%, unquote. The ADL adds that in years past, quote, older generations were more likely to harbor extensive anti-Semitic prejudice than younger generations. This survey found millennials and Generation Z have surpassed older Americans and agree with more anti-Jewish tropes than any other generational cohort. ADL survey also found that 27% of Americans would find it at least somewhat acceptable for a close family friend to support Hamas, and 24% of Americans have a close friend or family member who dislikes Jews, unquote. What explains the growing anti-Semitism of younger Americans? Well, we got a hint during congressional hearings on rising anti-Semitism on university campuses. That's when the presidents of America's elite universities refused to condemn anti-Semitism or say what steps their respective universities were taking to punish the offenders. When New York GOP Representative Elise Stefanik asked if calling for the genocide of Jews violated Harvard's code of conduct, University President Claudine Gay infamously said that it depended on the, quote, context, unquote. Gay's awkward response led to her stepping down as president, while remaining a tenured member in good standing of Harvard University's esteemed faculty. Harvard's motto, Veritas, Latin for truth, has been the institution's maxim since its 1636 founding. According to the university, quote, Harvard's commitment to truth is evident in the rich tapestry of academic disciplines and research interests represented on campus. Students from all walks of life come together to engage in intellectual discourse, sharing their unique perspectives and challenging each other's ideas, unquote. That's clearly untrue, especially for Harvard's Jewish students, some of whom filed suit against the university, in which a portion of the complaint states, quote, mobs of pro-Palestinian students and faculty have marched by the hundreds through Harvard's campus, shouting vile anti-Semitic slogans and calling for death to Jews and Israel. Those mobs have occupied buildings, classrooms, libraries, student lounges, plazas, and study halls, often for days and weeks at a time, promoting violence against Jews, unquote. So much for students from all walks of life coming together to engage in intellectual discourse. Universities have become grievance factories for race, gender, and now genocidal terrorism. This educational angst has no practical application in the real world. After all, it's hard to see how all this focused hostility can be used to build a better mousetrap. This means graduates with degrees in grievance have only one career path, the university. And the growing cancer of grievance, now devouring every corner of today's campus, crowds out such peaceful educational pursuits as literature, physics, chemistry, and music. And all that hate makes the so-called dismal science of economics seem a lot less dismal. This anti-Jewish hostility has forced some universities to hold classes online. So what's the point of building and maintaining brick-and-mortar universities if their primary purpose is to serve as Ivy League Jew-hating terrorist-supporting encampments? Taxpayers, not to mention tuition-paying parents, should demand more of universities. But there is a glimmer of hope in all this. Just freeze-frame any news footage of pro-Hamas demonstrations on any college campus and look carefully at the crowd chanting death to Israel. It's impossible not to notice that many of the faces in the crowd are those of young women. In fact, they are the most aggressive, making demands of college authorities whose offices they occupy, such as those at Columbia University.
Why should the university be obligated to provide food to people who've taken over a building?
First of all, we're saying that they're obligated to provide food to students who pay for a meal plan here.
But you mentioned that there was a request that food and water be brought in, unless I misunderstood.
To allow it to be brought in. I mean, well, I guess it's ultimately a question of what kind of community and obligation Columbia feels it has to its students. Do you want students to die of dehydration and starvation or get severely ill, even if they disagree with you? If the answer is no, then you should allow basic, I mean, it's crazy to say because we're on an Ivy League campus, but this is like basic humanitarian aid we're asking for. Like, could people please have a glass of water?
But they did put themselves in that, very deliberately, in that situation and in that position. So it seems like you're sort of saying, we want to be revolutionaries, we want to take up this building. Now would you please bring us food and water?
Nobody's asking them to bring anything. We're asking them to not violently stop us from bringing in basic humanitarian aid.
They're stopping the delivery of food?
We are looking for a commitment from them that they will not stop it violently.
They haven't stopped it yet.
I don't know to what extent it has been attempted, but we're looking for a commitment.
Behind the hungry and insistent female revolutionary stands a swarthy Middle Eastern-looking male dressed like a Hamas fighter, nodding gravely in agreement with the leader's request that DoorDash vegan food deliveries not be impeded. How many of you believe the same scene occurs among Hamas fighters in Gaza? Does my question make you smile? It should, and that's the point. What we are seeing on university campuses around the country is not a revolution that rejects Western civilization and its values. Rather, it's a rational female anger revealing itself through spectacular foot-stomping tantrums. Many will call my observation sexist. Guilty as charged. I do not bow before the altar of feminism, especially after seeing so-called feminists remain silent as the transgender movement erases what it means to be a real woman. Transgender advocates have condescendingly relegated biological females to the role of, quote, birthing persons, unquote. They take this absurdity one step further by insisting even men can get pregnant. In other words, what we are witnessing on university campuses is not revolutionary politics, but sexual politics. And it is white women, not olive-skinned men wrapped in Palestinian keffiyehs, that are clearly in charge. So, it's more than a little disconcerting when seemingly robust Jewish men of college age cower in fear of short, angry women blocking their path to class. Instead of gently pushing these women aside and getting on with their day, these men turn to the news cameras and wallow in their victimhood. When pro-Palestinian demonstrators at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill attempted to replace the Stars and Stripes with a Palestinian flag, the fraternity brothers at Pi Kappa Phi rushed in to save the day. As the estrogen-fueled crowd pelted the young muscular frat boys with plastic water bottles and loud insults, these real men surrounded Old Glory and saved her, chanting, USA, USA. As of this recording, a GoFundMe page created on behalf of the fraternity has raised over $500,000 to throw the men a campus rager. This sizable amount of cash will buy a lot of pizza and beer, not to mention the services of a live band. Chicks will love it. While opinion leaders like billionaire technologist Elon Musk decry the sharp decrease in birth rates within the Western world, the real concern should be focused on the steep decline in old-fashioned masculinity among men. And that brings us back to the reason for the feminine, pro-Palestinian unrest on today's college campuses. Israel's response to the Hamas atrocities of last October 7th has been decidedly manly and single-focused. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, a former military man known to have fired a gun in anger, has been unwavering in his determination to eliminate Hamas as a threat to his nation. Only after smashing the Hamas-controlled Gaza Strip into dust has Netanyahu agreed to the idea of a ceasefire. If one is ultimately reached, there is little doubt Hamas will break the terms. They are fickle, after all. It's probably hormonal. GOP Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell is a worthless squish who believes his role in life is to help Democrats pass bad legislation, like the recent $60 billion aid package for authoritarian and corrupt Ukraine. Meanwhile, GOP House Speaker Mike Johnson, who originally pledged to tie Ukraine funding to legislation stemming the flood of illegal aliens crossing our southern border, caved to McConnell and passed the Ukraine aid package with no conditions attached. Once again, Republicans fulfilled the familiar pattern of giving away the farm for no benefit at all. The GOP's conventional conservatives and never-Trumpers never seem to question why this defeatist pattern exists. But a considerable number of voters have certainly noticed this pattern, and it's fueled a movement in America. It's called MAGA, or Make America Great Again. The MAGA folks, you see, have noticed that this bipartisan coalition of Republicans and Democrats work together most of the time. In fact, the so-called opposition parties aren't really on opposite sides all that much these days. But this cozy coalition of Washington Republicans and Democrats are very much in agreement when it comes to what and who they oppose. And that's the will of we, the American people. No American was asked by Congress if making Ukraine our de facto 51st state was a good idea. No American was asked if the U.S. government should stop issuing drilling leases to oil companies, thus driving up the cost of fuel, and with it, the price of every good and service. No American asked to be forced against their will to purchase electric vehicles America's inadequate electric grid can't power. And no American asked that our southern border be open to one and all, with transportation, housing, and walking around cash provided the interlopers by Uncle Sam. Americans and Congress seem to be at odds concerning all the above. Congress members may campaign on liberal or conservative issues, but in the end, betray both. The issues of concern to Americans are of no interest to the unholy bipartisan swamp called Washington. The great unwashed and forgotten men and women of America mean little to Washington or the international elites whose agendas we are mandated to obey. That's why the Make America Great Again movement exists, and that's why the MAGA movement is hated by establishment Republicans and Democrats alike. The natural inclination of the powerful is to hate those who refuse to think of themselves as cattle, those who refuse to be ruled, those possessing an independent frame of mind. And blacks are joining this growing group of independent thinkers. When Trump ran for president in 2016, he garnered 8% of the black vote. In 2020, that number increased to 12%. A recent USA Today poll finds black support for Trump stands at 22%, an unprecedented number for a Republican presidential candidate. You may recall that back in 2020, then-candidate Joe Biden told black radio host Charlamagne tha God,
"If you have a problem figuring out whether you're for me or Trump, then you ain't black."
As racist as Biden's statement was, it resonated with one black opinion maker, Carla Hall of the Los Angeles Times. Quote, "As ridiculous as it was to say that to a black radio and TV personality, here's the thing. Biden was right. He just didn't have the right to say it. As a political and social liberal who is also black, I was dismayed that anyone, black or white, voted for Donald Trump in 2016. But I was particularly appalled when I saw anyone black campaign for him." Unquote. Hall's observation was as racist as Biden's. She believes her skin color gives her that right. But black voters aren't persuaded by subtle, not-so-subtle, or outright desperate appeals to race. Their lives and economic fortunes were better during the Trump administration and are particularly worse under Biden's. The same can be said for whites as well. In fact, the same can be said for Americans of all ages and persuasions. Americans' founding principle is that all men are created equal. And at this moment in American history, we are equal in our misery under Washington's wrong-headed rule. And that misery is coalescing into a multiracial, multiethnic, multi-class, nonpartisan, and populist movement called MAGA. GOP Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell will retire sometime in November. Clearly, McConnell knows his future is bleak as MAGA's influence in the Republican Party grows. It's not just the Republican Party stiff McConnell who fears MAGA. The unpopular head of the Democrats, President Joe Biden, is equally terrified. After all, he trails former President Donald Trump in 6 out of 7 battleground states. In a speech last September, Biden said,
"There's an extremist movement that does not share the basic beliefs in our democracy, the MAGA movement. But there's no question that today's Republican Party is driven and intimidated by MAGA Republican extremists. Their extreme agenda, if carried out, would fundamentally alter the institutions of American democracy as we know it. My friends, they're not hiding their attacks. They're openly promoting them, attacking the free press as the enemy of the people, attacking the rule of law as an impediment."
MAGA rejects America's institutions, such as the FBI, CIA, Justice Department, and their dutiful stenographers in the press, for their utter corruption and authoritarian leanings. And lack of voter identification and the preponderance of unverifiable mail-in ballots render so-called American democracy questionable. A Washington Post University of Maryland poll finds around 40% of Americans believe voter fraud allowed Democrats to steal the 2020 presidential election. Republican Mitch McConnell and Democrat Joe Biden, both fossilized and senile examples of America's dying political status quo, see and fear a changing America, one that increasingly rejects ruling elites. If you want to know why McConnell and Biden support open borders, through which an unprecedented flood of illegal immigrants has entered America, it's their desperate attempt to replace a U.S. voting pool that is angry at both parties. Those voters, who now gravitate to a populist voice untainted by the phony left-right debate. And that populist voice is Donald J. Trump. that concludes this edition of the More Than Right podcast. If you feel so inclined, please like and subscribe to the podcast. Until next time, this is Steve Lopez.